The topic, a spinster, the poet's poet. Introduction. A spinster's tombstone proclaim him to be the prince of the poets in his time. The truth will not be violated if we proclaim him to be the prince of the poet of all times. The prince of essays, Charles Lamb, appropriately designated the prince of poets, Edmund Spenser's the poet's poet. In spite of what some modern geniuses may say, Spenser's work strikes us as an exquisite embodiment of the ultimate in poetic excellence, which have been the rather mirage-like goal of all poetical endeavor. Beckoning all the generation of English poets after Spenser as an example and ideal. Whatever may be the other fault of Spenser, there is no gainsaying the fact that there is no dearth of the poetic in him. And the poetic faculty transform, like the philosopher, a stone or a magic wand, all the dross that it touches into the pure gold of genuine poetry. How intensely he influenced the succeeding poet, and how widely he excited imitation or common knowledge for a student of English literary history. Spenser's Through the Ages. The Spenser's contemporaries held him as the greatest of the poet of their age. We have mentioned above, he was often enthusiastically called the new poet. His eclogues in the Shepherd's Calendar and his epic The Faerie Queen earned him the very proud title of the English Virgil. The reputation that he gained among his contemporary poets was perpetuated over the ages after him by a very large number of poets who acknowledge him as their master and model. Spenser's poetic works provided the poet of all school practical lesson in the writing of excellent poetry. In no age was Spenser out of words. Dunn's reputation suffered a complete eclipse in the 18th century, the century of Pope, and Pope's own reputation fell in the 19th, but Spenser's reputation has remained constant like the lodestar, which twinkles but does not fade. Of course, in the early 18th century, the age of prose and reason, Spenser went somewhat out of vogue, vogue, but towards the middle of century, he became a source of inspiration for the poet like Croxhall and many others. The great Dr. Johnson looked with dismay and disapproval at the contemporary cult of imitating Spenser, but he could do nothing to stem the popular tide in spite of his being the arbiter of contemporary taste. Spenser was indeed, as James Reeves says, at no time out of fashion. He was, to quote the same critic, a copious source of inspiration to other poets for three centuries. It must be noted that, unlike Chaucer's influence on his immediate successor, Spenser's influence on his immediate successor was not so marked. Chaucer inspired a large number of Chaucerians, both in England and Scotland, who cherished aim was to write like their master or even father, in bracket, as Lydgate called him. Spenser, the second father of English poetry, did not generate such a tremendously imitative tendency. The reason for is what the rise and extreme popularization of the drama in the Elizabethan age. Most of literary geniuses up to about 20 years after the death of Spenser tried their hand at the writing of the drama. The most popular and paying literary genre of their age. But later on, even a poet of Milton's stature acknowledged him to be his original, and in Second Penseroso, he referred to him quite reverently as a poet who sang of Tournai's and of Torfi's hung, of forest and enhancement rearer, where more is meant than meets the ear. Further, in Areopagitica, he exalted him as our sage and serious Spenser. Cowley tells us how we read by reading a copy of Spenser's lying in his mother's parlor. He became a poet at the age of 12. Dryden proclaimed him as one of his two models, the other one being the smooth waller. Even in the 18th century, we find the great Pope himself praising Spenser and acknowledging his debt to the Shepherd's Calendar in the writing of his own pastorals. Addison, however, in his account of greatest English poets, dismissed the Fairy Queen as a mystic tale which can charm an understanding age no more. But it must be remembered that Addison's judgment of Spenser was as wanting in maturity as his summary dismissal of Chaucer as a rude barbarian who tries to make his reader laugh in vain. Addison wrote this critical, in fact uncritical, poem when he was a callow youth, and he was sensible enough in his years of maturity to dissociate himself from his patently irresponsible judgment. Still knew better when he observed in a Spectator that Spenser's number were exquisite. In the latter year of 18th century, with the birth of more imaginative spirit, Spenser came to be appreciated with a far keener sensitivity. Thomson and Stone not only caught a spark of Spenserian flame, but also used the Spenserian stanza to register a prosodic break with the heroic couplet of the Popian school, the former in his Castle of Indolence, and the latter in his School Mistress. To discuss the influence of Spenser on the early 19th century poets Wordsworth, Shelley, Coleridge and Keats will require a sizable volume. Keats in the Eve of a St. Agnes, Scott in the Vision of Don Roderick, Shelley in the Revolt of Islam, and Byron in his Childe Harold prolonged the Spenserian note. Though the last name was alien to the Spenserian spirit and once remarked, "I can make nothing to him," later in the Victorian age we find Spenser exerting a profound influence on Tennyson, becoming the ideal of Charles Doughty, Dougsty, and even being re-echoed in the Spenserian cadence, cadences, of the poem of Robert Bridges. Among modern poets, W.B. Yeats come nearest to him. Spenser's equipment as a poet. Why and how Spenser inspired and influenced such a large number of poets can be explained by pointing out that he had what every poet aspired to have, a fertile, teeming imagination wedded to exquisite craftsmanship. Some poets have too powerful an imagination but a poor degree of craftsmanship to wood it into artistic pattern of poetry. Blake is a representative example of such a poet whose imagination run away unbridled by artistic control. Some other poets have a rather productive imagination even though they are wonderful craftsmen. Spenser is one of the ideal poets like Homer, Virgil, Shakespeare and Milton who have a fertile imagination which is perfectly molded into poetry by their uncanny sense of pattern and architectonics. In addition to their mastery of the poetic idiom with all its suggestiveness, Spenser was fully equipped as a poet. He was as learned as Milton. As a child of Renaissance, he was well read into the classics which were in his age beginning to exercise a hold on scholar and man of letters. He was an MA from Cambridge University and well grounded in the tradition of Greek and Latin poetry, as also the poetry of Renaissance, Italy and France. Homer, Virgil and Ovid on the one hand, and Tasso, Ariosto, Petrarch, Ronsard and Du Bellay on the other, were at his fingertips. In his poetic works he freely drew upon them, with the result that there grew a number of similarities, stylistics as well as thematic, between his own works and the works of the above named master before him. And that is not all. Spencer was well versed even in the philosopher Plato and Aristotle, out of whom the former exercised a strong hold upon his mind. In his Four Hymns and elsewhere, he effectively and unmistakably gives expression to his Platonism, which believes that we should ascend from a specific embodiment of beauty to the idea of beauty itself. This idea of beauty is divine, and its contemplation something religious in nature. Nor was Spencer ignorant of the medieval lore. Though he disapproved medieval pattern of thought, yet he loved to breathe the medieval air with all its fairy land tint of chivalry, knight errantry, religious fervor, plus all its superstition and backgroundness. He captured this air exquisitely in the Fairy Queen. Then he was greatly influenced by the Reformation too, and in his work were not unconscious of his Puritanic temper. Thus he exhibited a rarely synthesizing temper and mind, which is the hallmark of every poet who aspired for universal fame. With all his poetic equipment, it was natural for him to be the envy of all poets. He wrote for the cultivated and the initiated, and not what in Europe and America are called the common people, and in India the masses. He was the poet and not the people's poet in any sense, Marxian or otherwise. Spencer's poetic genius. But all the Spencer's learning, the scholarly equipment, would have been no avail if he did not have the all-important poetic impulse, which was necessarily to electrify it into poetry. Even a huge dump of fuel fails to give heat without the all-important spark. Spencer had this spark. Even captious Addison admitted that Spencer was warmed with poetic rage. This poetic rage, genius and impulse is hard to define, but it unmistakably shows itself in very page and every line of Spencer's work. Spencer may be a prodigiously learned man, but what matters most is his poetic genius. The Fairy Queen, says W. P. Kerr in inverted comma, is the truest sort of poetry in which the poetic genius declares itself most truly as distinct from other kinds of genius. I want to come close. Leigh Hunt likewise observed, take him in short for what he is, whether greater or less than his fellow. The poetic faculty is so abundantly and beautifully predominant and him above every other. W. L. Renwick appropriately remarks, beyond question, what moved Spencer to write was a genuine poetic impulse. He sang because he must, not only because people listened. He sang not because he was learned, or an intense votary of the Reformation or the Renaissance, but because his imagination longed for outward embodiment, because it must give birth to its divine conception, because it insisted on relief and deliverance. In other words, Spencer's poetry is a true incarnation of a poetical spirit, not the elaborate effort of partition, literary, political, religious. When it comes close, as is said about Shelley, Spencer excels verses as a follower excels fragrance. He cannot help it. W. L. Renwick further point out that even when Spencer's time sometimes uses material which is prosaic enough, he transformed it into the true poetry. He refers in his connection of the description of the house of Alma in Book Second of the Faerie Queen and the versification of Geoffrey of Monmouth, History of Breton. In the following canto, I have observed that whatever be the difficulties in Spenser's path, they never ceases to be a poet. He always flies and never creeps or even walk. Nobody has ever posed the question, as was done too openly and too repeatedly in the case of Pope, whether he is a poet or not. He is not only a poet, a great poet, but the poet's poet of all the poets. Observe Hazlitt. He is the most poetical. He offers in his work the quintessence of poeticlessness. Quintessence, Quintessence of poeticlessness. Spenser's deft craftsmanship. Added to Spenser's vigorous poetic impulse, his virtuosity and sureness of touch as a craftsman, he has a perfect mastery over his medium word. He does whatever he likes with words and makes them responsive to all sort of mood and feeling. His poetry has a rare pictorial quality which was sought to be imitated by poets like Keats, Swinburne, Tennyson and many more. He was, as Lewis so well puts it, a painter who never held a brush. With equal justice, we many remark that he was a musician who never wielded a musical instrument. The English language, tattered and jacked as it had become by a awkward awkward handling of the 15th century poet like Lysgaet, Lysgaeten, Skelton, in Spenser's hand not only regained the harmony of Chaucer's number, but vastly added to its musical quality, in which it was previously much below Italian and French. He seems able, writes Lewis, to tune English verse, which had been so long rebellious to the natural tone of his verse. For him, language ceased to be refractory. It may be true that, as Ben Jonson complained, Spenser wrote no language. But whatever he wrote, bespeak a highly poetic spirit subject to the process of exquisite craftsmanship, which has always remained with the poets of all ages a thing of professional interest and emulation. It is in this sense too that Spenser can be called the poet's poet. Spenser's importance. Spenser appears as a source of inspiration for the succeeding poet because through his example he implied so that the height were within reach of English poetry, and he did actually make his poetry reach them. In his age, the age of Renaissance, before they started writing, England had to show nothing to compare with the poetry of the Italian Renaissance, poets such as Ariosto, Tasso and Petrarch. In the French Renaissance, poets like Ronsard and Du Bellay. By his poetic effort, Spenser proved that, to quote Renwick in Nunnutkama, modern England was capable of poetry as great as that of any other race, and that she had her share of poetic power of art and learning. In order to come close, in his pastoralism, the Shepherd's Calendar, he challenged comparison with the ancient Theocritus, Theocritus, and Virgil. In his sonneteering with Petrarch and Ronsard, in his epic writing, Tasso and Ariosto, and in his imaginative fertility and craftsmanship with any poet ancient of modern. He taught his countrymen once and for all not to look for for poetic gems to Italy or France, but to their own country, for it had come after all to have a great poet, the poet's poet. The topic, Spencer's The Poet's Poet, over.